This is Audible.
Listening Library presents An Ember in the Ashes by Saba Tahir. Read for you by Fiona Hardingham and Steve West. Part 1. The Raid. Chapter 1. Liar. My big brother reaches home in the dark hours before dawn, when even ghosts take their rest. He smells of steel and coal and forge. He smells of the enemy. He folds his scarecrow body through the window, bare feet silent on the rushes. A hot desert wind blows in after him, rustling the limp curtains. His sketchbook falls to the floor, and he nudges it under his bunk with a quick foot, as if it's a snake. "Where have you been, Darin?" In my head, I have the courage to ask the question, and Darin trusts me enough to answer. "Why do you keep disappearing? Why, when Pop and Nan need you? When I need you?" Every night for almost 2 years I've wanted to ask. Every night I've lacked the courage. I have one sibling left. I don't want him to shut me out like he has everyone else. But tonight's different. I know what's in his sketchbook. I know what it means. "You shouldn't be awake." Darin's whisper jolts me from my thoughts. He has a cat's sense for traps. He got it from our mother. I sit up on the bunk as he lights the lamp. No use pretending to be asleep. "It's past curfew, and 3 patrols have gone by. I was worried." "I can avoid the soldiers, Liar. Lots of practice." He rests his chin on my bunk and smiles mother's sweet, crooked smile. A familiar look, the one he gives me if I wake from a nightmare or we run out of grain. "Everything will be fine," the look says. He picks up the book on my bed. "Gather in the Night," he reads the title. "Spooky. What's it about?" "I just started it. It's about a djinn." I stop. "Clever. Very clever. He likes hearing stories as much as I like telling them."
"Forget that. Where were you? Pop had a dozen patients this morning."
"And I filled in for you because he can't do so much alone, which left Nan to bottle the trader's jams by herself. Except she didn't finish. Now the trader won't pay us, and we'll starve this winter. And why in the skies don't you care?" I say these things in my head. The smile's already dropped off Darin's face. "I'm not cut out for healing," he says. "Pop knows that." I want to back down, but I think of Pop's slumped shoulders this morning. I think of the sketchbook. "Pop and Nan depend on you. At least talk to them. It's been months." I wait for him to tell me that I don't understand, that I should leave him be. But he just shakes his head, drops down into his bunk, and closes his eyes like he can't be bothered to reply. "I saw your drawings." The words tumble out in a rush. And Darin's up in an instant, his face stony.
"I wasn't spying," I say. "One of the pages was loose. I found it when I changed the rushes this morning."
"Did you tell Nan and Pop? Did they see?"
"No, but..."
"Liar, listen."
10 hells, I don't want to hear this. I don't want to hear his excuses.
"What you saw is dangerous," he says.
"You can't tell anyone about it.
Not ever. It's not just my life at risk. There are others.
Are you working for the Empire, Darin? Are you working for the Marshals?"
He is silent. I think I see the answer in his eyes, and I feel ill.
"My brother is a traitor to his own people. My brother is siding with the Empire. If he hoarded grain or sold books or taught children to read, I'd understand. I'd be proud of him for doing the things I'm not brave enough to do. The Empire raids, jails, and kills for such crimes. But teaching a 6-year-old her letters isn't evil. Not in the minds of my people, the scholar people. But what Darin has done is sick. It's a betrayal. The Empire killed our parents, I whisper. Our sister.
I want to shout at him, but I choke on the words. The Marshals conquered Scholar Lands 500 years ago, and since then, they've done nothing but oppress and enslave us. Once, the Scholar Empire was home to the finest universities and libraries in the world. Now, most of our people can't tell a school from an armory.
How could you side with the Marshals? How, Darin?
It's not what you think, Lyra. I'll explain everything, but... He pauses suddenly, his hand jerking up to silence me when I ask for the promised explanation. He cocks his head toward the window. Through the thin walls, I hear Pop snores, Nan shifting in her sleep, a mourning dove's croon. Familiar sounds, home sounds. Darin hears something else. The blood drains from his face and dread flashes in his eyes. Lyra, he says. Raid.
But if you work for the Empire, then why are the soldiers raiding us?
I'm not working for them. He sounds calm, calmer than I feel. Hide the sketchbook. That's what they want. That's what they're here for. Then he's out the door, and I'm alone. My bare legs move like cold molasses, my hands like wooden blocks. Hurry, Lyra! Usually, the Empire raids in the heat of the day. The soldiers want scholar mothers and children to watch. They want fathers and brothers to see another man's family enslaved. As bad as those raids are, the night raids are worse. The night raids are for when the Empire doesn't want witnesses.
I wonder if this is real, if it's a nightmare.
It's real, Lyra. Move. I drop the sketchbook out the window into a hedge. It's a poor hiding place, but I have no time. Nan hobbles into my room, her hands so steady when she stirs vats of jam or braids my hair, flutter like frantic birds, desperate for me to move faster. She pulls me into the hallway. Darin stands with Pop at the back door. My grandfather's white hair is scattered as a haystack, and his clothes are wrinkled. But there's no sleep in the deep grooves of his face. He murmurs something to my brother, then hands him Nan's largest kitchen knife. I don't know why he bothers. Against the Cyric steel of a martial blade, the knife will only shatter.
You and Darin leave through the backyard, Nan says, her eyes darting from window to window. They haven't surrounded the house yet. No, no, no. Nan? I breathe her name, stumbling when she pushes me toward Pop. Hide in the east end of the quarter. Her sentence ends in a choke, her eyes on the front window. Through the ragged curtains, I catch a flash of a liquid silver face. My stomach clenches. A mask, Nan says. They've brought a mask. Go, Lyra, before he gets inside.
What about you? What about Pop?
We'll hold them off. Pop shoves me gently out the door. Keep your secrets close, love. Listen to Darin. He'll take care of you. Go.
Darin's lean shadow falls over me, and he grabs my hand as the door closes behind us. He slouches to blend into the warm night, moving silently across the loose sand of the backyard with a confidence I wish I felt. Although I am 17 and old enough to control my fear, I grip his hand like... it's the only solid thing in this world.
I'm not working for them, Darin said.
Then whom is he working for? Somehow he got close enough to the forges of Sarah to draw, in detail, the creation process of the Empire's most precious asset, the unbreakable, curved Sims that can cut through three men at once. Half a millennium ago, the scholars crumbled beneath the martial invasion because our blades broke against their superior steel. Since then, we have learned nothing of steelcraft. The marshals hoard their secrets the way a miser hoards gold. Anyone caught near our city's forges without good reason, scholar or marshal, risks execution.
If Darin isn't with the Empire, how did he get near Sarah's forges? How did the Marshals find out about his sketchbook? On the other side of the house, a fist pounds on the front door. Boots shuffle, steel clinks. I look around, wildly, expecting to see the silver armor and red capes of Empire legionnaires. But the backyard is still. The fresh night air does nothing to stop the sweat rolling down my neck. Distantly, I hear the thud of drums from Blackcliff, the mask training school. The sound sharpens my fear into a hard point stabbing at my center. The Empire doesn't send those silver-faced monsters on just any raid. The pounding on the door sounds again.
"In the name of the Empire!" an irritated voice says. "I demand you open this door!"
As one, Darin and I freeze. "Doesn't sound like a mask," Darin whispers. "Masks speak softly with words that cut through you like a sim. In the time it would take a legionnaire to knock and issue an order, a mask would already be in the house, weapons slicing through anyone in his way." Darin meets my eyes, and I know we're both thinking the same thing. If the mask isn't with the rest of the soldiers at the front door, then where is he? "Don't be afraid, Lyra," Darin says. "I won't let anything happen to you." I want to believe him, but my fear is a tide tugging at my ankles, pulling me under. I think of the couple that lived next door, raided, imprisoned, and sold into slavery 3 weeks ago. "Book smugglers," the marshal said. 5 days after that, one of Pop's oldest patients, a 93-year-old man who could barely walk, was executed in his own home. His throat slit from ear to ear. Resistance collaborator. What will the soldiers do to Nan and Pop? Jail them? Enslave them? Kill them? We reach the back gate. Darin stands on his toes to unhook the latch when a scrape in the alley beyond stops him short. A breeze sighs past, sending a cloud of dust into the air. Darin pushes me behind him. His knuckles are white around the knife handle as the gate swings open with a moan. A finger of terror draws a trail up my spine. I peer over my brother's shoulder into the alley. There is nothing out there but the quiet shifting of sand. Nothing but the occasional gust of wind and the shuttered windows of our sleeping neighbors. I sigh in relief and step around Darin. That's when the mask emerges from the darkness and walks through the gate.
Chapter 2. Elias. The deserter will be dead before dawn. His tracks zigzag like a stuck deer's in the dust of Sarah's catacombs. The tunnels have done him in. The hot air is too heavy down here. The smells of death and rot too close. The tracks are more than an hour old by the time I see them. The guards have his scent now. Poor bastard. If he's lucky, he'll die in the chase. If not, don't think about it. Hide the backpack. Get out of here. Skulls crunch as I shove a pack loaded with food and water into a wall crypt. Helene would give me hell if she could see how I'm treating the dead. But then, if Helene finds out why I'm down here in the first place, desecration will be the least of her complaints. She won't find out. Not until it's too late. Guilt pricks at me, but I shove it away. Helene's the strongest person I know. She'll be fine without me. For what feels like the 100th time, I look over my shoulder. The tunnel is quiet. The deserter led the soldiers in the opposite direction. But safety's an illusion I know never to trust. I work quickly, piling bones back in front of the crypt to cover my trail, my senses primed for anything out of the ordinary. One more day of this. One more day of paranoia and hiding and lying. One day until graduation. Then I'll be free. As I rearrange the crypt's skulls, the hot air shifts like a bear waking from hibernation. The smells of grass and snow cut through the fetid breath of the tunnel. 2 seconds is all I have to step away from the crypt and kneel, examining the ground as if there might be tracks here. Then she is at my back.
Elias, what are you doing down here?
Didn't you hear? There's a deserter loose. I keep my attention fixed on the dusty floor. Beneath the silver mask that covers me from forehead to jaw, my face should be unreadable. But Helena Killer and I have been together nearly every day of the 14 years we've been training at Blackcliff Military Academy. She can probably hear me thinking. She comes around me silently, and I look up into her eyes, as blue and pale as the warm waters of the southern islands. My mask sits atop my face, separate and foreign, hiding my features as well as my emotions. But Hel's mask clings to her like a silvery second skin, and I can see the slight furrow in her brow as she looks down at me. Relax, Elias, I tell myself. You're just looking for a deserter.
He didn't come this way, Hel says.
She runs a hand over her hair, braided, as always, into a tight, silver-blonde crown.
Dex took an auxiliary company off the North Watchtower and into the East Branch Tunnel. You think they'll catch him?
Orc soldiers, though not as highly trained as legionnaires and nothing compared to masks, are still merciless hunters.
Of course they'll catch him.
I fail to keep the bitterness out of my voice, and Helene gives me a hard look.
The cowardly scum, I add. Anyway, why are you awake?
You weren't on watch this morning.
I made sure of it. Those bleeding drums,
Helene looks around the tunnel,
woke everyone up.
The drums, of course.
Deserter, they'd thundered in the middle of the graveyard watch. All active units to the walls.
Helene must have decided to join the hunt. Dex, my lieutenant, would have told her which direction I'd gone. He'd have thought nothing of it.
I thought the deserter might have come this way.
I turn from my hidden pack to look down another tunnel.
Guess I was wrong. I should catch up to Dex. Much as I hate to admit it, you're not usually wrong.
Helene cocks her head and smiles at me. I feel that guilt again, wrenching as a fist to the gut. She'll be furious when she learns what I've done. She'll never forgive me.
Doesn't matter. You've decided. Can't turn back now.
Hel traces the dust on the ground with a fair, practiced hand.
I've never even seen this tunnel before.
A drop of sweat crawls down my neck. I ignore it.
It's hot and it reeks, I say, like everything else down here. Come on, I want to add.
But doing so would be like tattooing, I'm up to no good, on my forehead. I keep quiet and lean against the catacomb wall, arms crossed.
The field of battle is my temple.
I mentally chant a saying my grandfather taught me the day he met me, when I was 6. He insists it sharpens the mind the way a whetstone sharpens a blade.
The sword point is my priest. The dance of death is my prayer. The killing blow is my release.
Helene peers at my blurred tracks, following them, somehow, to the crypt where I stowed my pack, to the skulls piled there. She's suspicious, and the air between us is suddenly tense.
Damn it!
I need to distract her. As she looks between me and the crypt, I run my gaze lazily down her body. She stands 2 inches shy of 6 feet, a half foot shorter than me.
She's the only female student at Blackcliff. In the black, close-fitting fatigues all students wear, her strong, slender form has always drawn admiring glances. Just not mine. We've been friends too long for that. Come on, notice. Notice me leering and get mad about it. When I meet her eyes, brazen as a sailor fresh into port, she opens her mouth, as if to rip into me. Then she looks back at the crypt. If she sees the pack and guesses what I'm up to, I'm done for. She might hate doing it, but Empire law would demand she report me, and Helene's never broken a law in her life. Elias, I prepare my lie. Just wanted to get away for a couple of days, hell. Needed some time to think. Didn't want to worry you. Boom, 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 boom. The drums. Without thought, I translate the disparate beats into the message they are meant to convey. Deserter caught. All students report to Central Courtyard immediately. My stomach sinks. Some naive part of me hoped the deserter would at least make it out of the city. That didn't take long, I say. We should go. I make for the main tunnel. Helene follows, as I knew she would. She would stab herself in the eye before she disobeyed a direct order. Helene is a true marshal, more loyal to the Empire than to her own mother. Like any good mask in training, she takes Blackcliff's motto to heart. Duty first, unto death. I wonder what she would say if she knew what I'd really been doing in the tunnels. I wonder how she'd feel about my hatred for the Empire. I wonder what she would do if she found out her best friend is planning to desert.
Chapter 3 Liar. The mask saunters through the gate, big hands loose at his sides. The strange metal of his namesake clings to him from forehead to jaw like silver paint, revealing every feature of his face, from the thin eyebrows to the hard angles of his cheekbones. His copper-plated armor molds to his muscles, emphasizing the power in his body. A passing wind billows his black cape, and he looks around the backyard like he's arrived at a garden party. His pale eyes find me, slide up my form, and settle on my face with a reptile's flat regard. Aren't you a pretty one? He says. I yank at the ragged hem of my shift, wishing desperately for the shapeless, ankle-length skirt I wear during the day. The mask doesn't even twitch. Nothing in his face tells me what he's thinking. But I can guess. Darren steps in front of me and glances at the fence as if gauging the time it will take to reach it. I'm alone, boy. The mask addresses Darren with all the emotion of a corpse. The rest of the men are in your house. You can run, if you like. He moves away from the gate. But I insist you leave the girl. Darren raises the knife. Chivalrous of you, the mask says. Then he strikes, a flash of copper and silver lightning out of an empty sky. In the time it takes me to gasp, the mask has shoved my brother's face into the sandy ground and pinned his writhing body with a knee. Nan's knife falls to the dirt. A scream erupts from me, lonely in the still summer night. Seconds later, a simpoint pricks my throat. I didn't even see the mask draw the weapon. Quiet, he says. Arms up. Now get inside. The mask uses one hand to yank Darren up by the neck, and the other to prod me on with his sim. My brother limps, face bloodied, eyes dazed. When he struggles, a fish on a hook, the mask tightens his grip. The back door of the house opens, and a red-caped legionnaire comes out. The house is secure, Commander. The mask shoves Darren at the soldier. Bind him up.
He's strong.
Then he grabs me by the hair, twisting until I cry out.
Hmm.
He bends his head to my ear, and I cringe, my terror caught in my throat.
I've always loved dark-haired girls.
I wonder if he has a sister, a wife, a woman. But it wouldn't matter if he did. To him, I'm not someone's family. I'm just a thing to be subdued, used, and discarded. The mask drags me down the hallway to the front room as casually as a hunter drags his kill. Fight, I tell myself. Fight! But as if he senses my pathetic attempts at bravery, his hand squeezes and pain lances through my skull. I sag and let him pull me along. Legionnaires stand shoulder to shoulder in the front room amid upturned furniture and broken bottles of jam. Trader won't get anything now. So many days spent over steaming kettles, my hair and skin smelling of apricot and cinnamon. So many jars, steamed and dried, filled and sealed. Useless, all useless. The lamps are lit and Nan and Pop kneel in the middle of the floor, their hands bound behind their backs. The soldier holding Darren shoves him to the ground beside them.
Shall I tie up the girl, sir?
Another soldier fingers the rope at his belt, but the mask leaves me between two burly legionnaires.
She's not going to cause any trouble.
He stabs at me with those eyes.
Are you?
I shake my head and shrink back, hating myself for being such a coward. I reach for my mother's tarnished armlet, wrapped around my bicep, and touch the familiar pattern for strength. I find none. Mother would have fought. She'd have died rather than face this humiliation. But I can't make myself move. My fear has ensnared me. A legionnaire enters the room, his face more than a little nervous.
It's not here, Commander.
The mask looks down at my brother.
Where's the sketchbook?
Darren stares straight ahead, silent. His breath is low and steady, and he doesn't seem dazed anymore. In fact, he's almost composed. The mask gestures a small movement. One of the legionnaires lifts Nan by her neck and slams her frail body against a wall. Nan bites her lip, her eyes sparking blue. Darren tries to rise, but another soldier forces him down. The mask scoops up a shard of glass from one of the broken jars. His tongue flickers out like a snake's as he tastes the jam.
Shame it's all gone to waste.
He caresses Nan's face with the edge of the shard.
You must have been beautiful once. Such eyes.
He turns to Darren.
Shall I carve them out of her?
It's outside the small bedroom window. In the hedge. I can't manage more than a whisper, but the soldiers hear. The mask nods, and one of the legionnaires disappears into the hallway. Darren doesn't look at me, but I feel his dismay. Why did you tell me to hide it? I want to cry out. Why did you bring the cursed thing home? The legionnaire returns with the book. For unending seconds, the only sound in the room is the rustling of pages as the mask flips through the sketches. If the rest of the book is anything like the page I found, I know what the mask will see. Martial knives, swords, scabbards, forges, formulas, instructions, things no scholar should know of, let alone recreate on paper.
How did you get into the weapons quarter, boy?
The mask looks up from the book.
Has the resistance been bribing some plebeian drudge to sneak you in?
I stifle a sob. Half of me is relieved Darian's no traitor. The other half wants to rage at him for being such a fool. Association with the scholar's resistance carries a death sentence.
I got myself in, my brother says. The resistance had nothing to do with it. You were seen entering the catacombs last night after curfew, the mask almost sounds bored, in the company of known scholar rebels. Last night he was home well before curfew, Pop speaks up, and it is strange to hear my grandfather lie, but it makes no difference. The mask's eyes are for my brother alone. The man doesn't blink as he reads Darin's face the way I'd read a book. Those rebels were taken into custody today, the mask says. One of them gave up your name before he died. What were you doing with them? They followed me. Darin sounds so calm, like he's done this before, like he's not afraid at all. I'd never met them before. And yet, they knew of your book here, told me all about it. How did they learn of it? What did they want from you? I don't know. The mask presses the shard of glass deep into the soft skin below Nan's eye, and her nostrils flare. A trickle of blood traces a wrinkle down her face. Darin draws a sharp breath, the only sign of strain. They asked for my sketchbook, he says. I said no. I swear it. And their hideout? I didn't see. They blindfolded me. We were in the catacombs. Where in the catacombs? I didn't see. They blindfolded me. The mask eyes my brother for a long moment. I don't know how Darin can remain unruffled beneath that gaze. You're prepared for this. The smallest bit of surprise creeps into the mask's voice. Straight back, deep breathing, same answers to different questions. Who trained you, boy? When Darin doesn't answer, the mask shrugs. A few weeks in prison will loosen your tongue. Nan and I exchange a frightened glance. If Darin ends up in a martial prison, we'll never see him again. He'll spend weeks in interrogation, and after that they'll either sell him as a slave or kill him. He's just a boy, Pop speaks slowly, as if to an angry patient. Please. Steel flashes, and Pop drops like a stone. The mask moves so swiftly that I don't understand what he has done. Not until Nan rushes forward, not until she lets out a shrill keen, a shaft of pure pain that brings me to my knees. Pop! Skies, not Pop! A dozen vows sear themselves into my mind. I'll never disobey again. I'll never do anything wrong. I'll never complain about my work if only Pop lives. But Nan tears her hair and screams, and if Pop was alive, he'd never let her go on like that. He wouldn't have been able to bear it. Darin's calm is sheared away as if by a scythe, his face blanched with a horror I feel down to my bones. Nan stumbles to her feet and takes one tottering step toward the mask. He reaches out to her as if to put his hand on her shoulder. The last thing I see in my grandmother's eyes is terror. Then the mask's gauntleted wrist flashes once, leaving a thin red line across Nan's throat, a line that grows wider and redder as she falls. Her body hits the floor with a thud, her eyes still open and shining with tears as blood pours from her neck and into the rug we knotted together last winter. Sir, one of the legionnaires says, an hour until dawn. Get the boy out of here. The mask doesn't give Nan a second glance. And burn this place down. He turns to me then, and I wish I could fade like a shadow into the wall behind me. I wish for it harder than I've ever wished for anything, knowing all the while how foolish it is. The soldiers flanking me grin at each other as the mask takes a slow step in my direction. He holds my gaze as if he can smell my fear,
A cobra enthralling its prey. No, please, no. Disappear. I want to disappear. The mask blinks, some foreign emotion flickering across his eyes. Surprise or shock, I can't tell. It doesn't matter, because in that moment, Darin leaps up from the floor. While I cowered, he loosened his bindings. His hands stretch out like claws as he lunges for the mask's throat. His rage lends him a lion's strength, and for a second he is every inch our mother. Honey hair glowing, eyes blazing, mouth twisted in a feral snarl. The mask backs into the blood pool near Nan's head, and Darin is on him, knocking him to the ground, raining down blows. The legionnaires stand frozen in disbelief and then come to their senses, surging forward, shouting and swearing. Darin pulls a dagger free from the mask's belt before the legionnaires tackle him. Liar, my brother shouts. Run! Don't run, liar. Help him. Fight. But I think of the mask's cold regard, of the violence in his eyes.
I've always loved dark-haired girls.
He will rape me. Then he will kill me. I shudder, and back into the hallway. No one stops me. No one notices. Liar! Darin cries out, sounding like I've never heard him, frantic, trapped. He told me to run. But if I screamed like that, he would come. He would never lead me. I stop. Help him, liar, a voice orders in my head. Move. And another voice, more insistent, more powerful. You can't save him. Do what he says. Run. Flame flickers at the edge of my vision, and I smell smoke. One of the legionnaires has started torching the house. In minutes, fire will consume it.
Bind him properly this time, and get him into an interrogation cell.
The mask removes himself from the fray, rubbing his jaw. When he sees me backing down the hallway, he goes strangely still. Reluctantly, I meet his eyes, and he tilts his head.
Run, little girl, he says.
My brother is still fighting, and his screams slice right through me. I know then that I will hear them over and over again, echoing in every hour of every day until I am dead or I make it right. I know it, and still I run. The cramped streets and dusty markets of the Scholars' Quarter blur past me like the landscape of a nightmare. With each step, part of my brain shouts at me to turn around, to go back, to help Darin. With each step, it becomes less likely, until it isn't a possibility at all, until the only word I can think is, run. The soldiers come after me, but I've grown up among the squat, mud brick houses of the quarter, and I lose my pursuers quickly. Dawn breaks, and my panicked run turns to a stumble as I wander from alley to alley. Where do I go? What do I do? I need a plan, but I don't know where to start. Who can offer me help or comfort? My neighbors will turn me away, fearing for their own lives. My family is dead or imprisoned. My best friend, Zara, disappeared in a raid last year, and my other friends have their own troubles. I'm alone. As the sun rises, I find myself in an empty building deep in the oldest part of the quarter. The gutted structure crouches like a wounded animal amid a labyrinth of crumbling dwellings. The stench of refuse taints the air. I huddle in the corner of the room. My hair has slipped free of its braid and lays in hopeless tangles. The red stitches along the hem of my shift are ripped, the bright yarn limp. Nan sewed those hems for my 17th year fall, to brighten up my otherwise drab clothing. It was one of the few gifts she could afford. Now, she's dead. Like Pop, like my parents and sister, long ago. And Darin, taken, dragged to an interrogation cell where the marshals will do who knows what to him. Life is made of so many moments that mean nothing. Then one day, a single moment comes along to define every second that comes after. The moment Darin called out, that was such a moment. It was a test of courage, of strength. And I failed it. Liar. Run. Why did I listen to him? I should have stayed. I should have done something. I moan and grasp my head. I keep hearing him. Where is he now? Have they begun the interrogation? He'll wonder what happened to me. He'll wonder how his sister could have left him. A flicker of furtive movement in the shadows catches my attention, and the hair on my nape rises. A rat? A crow? The shadows shift, and within them two malevolent eyes flash. More sets of eyes join the first, baleful and slitted. Hallucinations, I hear Pop in my head, making a diagnosis, a symptom of shock. Hallucinations or not, the shadows look real. Their eyes glow with the fire of miniature suns, and they circle me like hyenas, growing bolder with each pass.
We saw, they hiss. We know your weakness. He'll die because of you.
No, I whisper. But they are right, these shadows. I left Darin. I abandoned him. The fact that he told me to go doesn't matter. How could I have been so cowardly? I grasp my mother's armlet, but touching it makes me feel worse. Mother would have outfoxed the mask. Somehow she'd have saved Darin and Nan and Pop. Even Nan was braver than me. Nan with her frail body and burning eyes. Her backbone of steel. Mother inherited Nan's fire, and after her, Darin. But not me.
Run, little girl.
The shadows inch closer, and I close my eyes against them, hoping they'll disappear. I grasp at the thoughts ricocheting through my mind, trying to corral them. Distantly, I hear shouts and the thud of boots. If the soldiers are still looking for me, I'm not safe here. Maybe I should let them find me and do what they will. I abandoned my blood. I deserve punishment. But the same instinct that urged me to escape the mask in the first place drives me to my feet. I head into the streets, losing myself in the thickening morning crowds. A few of my fellow scholars look twice at me, some with wariness, others with sympathy. But most don't look at all. It makes me wonder how many times I walked right past someone in these streets who was running, someone who had just had their whole world ripped from them. I stopped to rest in an alley slick with sewage. Thick black smoke curls up from the other side of the quarter, paling as it rises into the hot sky. My home, burning. Nan's jams, Pop's medicines, Darin's drawings, my books, gone. Everything I am, gone. Not everything, liar. Not Darin. A grate squats in the center of the alley, just a few feet away from me. Like all grates in the quarter, it leads down into the Sarah's catacombs, home to skeletons, ghosts, rats, thieves, and possibly the scholars' resistance. Had Darin been spying for them? Had the resistance gotten him into the weapons quarter? Despite what my brother told the mask, it's the only answer that makes sense. Rumor has it that the resistance fighters have been getting bolder, recruiting not just scholars, but mariners from the free country of Marin, to the north and tribesmen whose desert territory is an empire protectorate. Papa Nan never spoke of the resistance in front of me, but late at night I heard the murmuring of how the rebels freed scholar prisoners while striking out at the marshals, of how fighters raided the caravans of the martial merchant class, the Mercators, and assassinated members of their upper class, the Illustrians. Only the rebels stand up to the marshals. Elusive as they are the only weapon the scholars have. If anyone can get near the forges, it's them. The resistance, I realize, might help me. My home was raided and burned to the ground, my family killed because two of the rebels gave Darin's name to the Empire. If I can find the resistance and explain what happened, maybe they can help me break Darin free from prison. Not just because they owe me, but because they live by Izzat, a code of honor as old as the scholar people. The rebel leaders are the best of the scholars, the bravest. My parents taught me that before the Empire killed them. If I ask for aid, the resistance won't turn me away. I step toward the grate. I've never been in Sarah's catacombs. They snake beneath the entire city, hundreds of miles of tunnels and caverns, some packed with centuries' worth of bones. No one uses the crypts for burial anymore, and even the Empire hasn't mapped out the catacombs entirely. If the Empire, with all its might, can't hunt out the rebels, then how will I find them? You won't stop until you do. I lift the grate and stare into the black hole below. I have to go down there. I have to find the resistance. Because if I don't, my brother doesn't stand a chance. If I don't find the fighters and get them to help, I'll never see Darin again.
Chapter 4. Elias. By the time Helene and I reach Blackcliff's bell tower, nearly all of the school's 3,000 students have formed up. Dawn's an hour away, but I don't see a single sleepy eye. Instead, an eager buzz runs through the crowd. The last time someone deserted, the courtyard was covered in frost. Every student knows what's coming. I clench and unclench my fists. I don't want to watch this. Like all Blackcliff students, I came to the school at the age of 6, and in the 14 years since, I've witnessed punishments thousands of times. My own back is a map of the school's brutality. But deserters are always the worst. My body is tight as a spring, but I flatten my gaze and keep my expression emotionless. Blackcliff's subject masters, the Centurions, will be watching. Drawing their ire when I'm so close to escaping would be unforgivably stupid. Helene and I walk past the youngest students, four classes of maskless yearlings who will have the clearest view of the carnage. The smallest are barely 7, the biggest nearly 11. The yearlings look down as we pass. We are upperclassmen, and they are forbidden from even addressing us. They stand poker straight, Sims hanging at precise 45-degree angles on their backs, boots spit-shined, faces blank as stone. By now, even the youngest yearlings have learned Blackcliff's most essential lessons. Obey, conform, and keep your mouth shut. Behind the yearlings sits an empty space in honor of Blackcliff's second tier of students, called Fivers because so many die in their fifth year. At age 11, the Centurions throw us out of Blackcliff and into the wilds of the Empire without clothes, food, or weaponry, to survive as best as we can for 4 years. The remaining Fivers return to Blackcliff, receive their masks, and spend another 4 years as cadets, and then 2 more years as Skulls. Hel and I are senior Skulls, just completing our last year of training. The Centurions monitor us from beneath the arches that line the courtyard, hands on their whips as they await the arrival of Blackcliff's commandant. They stand as still as statues, their masks long since melded to their features, any semblance of emotion a distant memory. I put a hand to my own mask, wishing I could rip it off, even for a minute. Like my classmates, I received the mask on my first day as a cadet, when I was 14. Unlike the rest of the students, and much to Helene's dismay, the smooth liquid silver hasn't dissolved into my skin like it's supposed to, probably because I take the damned thing off whenever I'm alone. I've hated the mask since the day an augur, an Empire holy man, handed it to me in a velvet-lined box. I hate the way it gloams onto me like some kind of parasite. I hate the way it presses into my face, molding itself to my skin. I'm the only student whose mask hasn't melded to him yet, something my enemies enjoy pointing out. But lately, the mask has started fighting back, forcing the melding process by digging tiny filaments into the back of my neck. It makes my skin crawl, makes me feel like I'm not myself anymore, like I'll never be myself again.
Vittorius!
Hell's lanky, sandy-haired platoon lieutenant, Demetrius, calls out to me as we take our spots with the other senior skulls.
Who is it? Who's the deserter?
I don't know. Dex and the Orcs brought him in. I look around for my lieutenant, but he hasn't arrived yet.
I hear it's a yearling.
Demetrius stares at a hunk of wood poking out of the blood-browned cobbles at the base of the bell tower. The whipping post.
An older one. A fourth year.
Helene and I exchange a look. Demetrius's little brother also tried to desert in his fourth year at Blackcliff, when he was only 10. He lasted 3 hours outside the gates before the legionnaires brought him in to face the commandant, longer than most.
Maybe it was a skull.
Helene scans the ranks of older students, trying to see if anyone is missing.
Maybe it was Marcus.
Varys, a member of my battle platoon who towers over the rest of us, says, grinning, his blonde hair popping up in an unruly cowlick.
Or Zack.
No such luck. Marcus, dark-skinned and yellow-eyed, stands at the front of our ranks with his twin, Zack, second-born, shorter and lighter, but just as evil. The snake and the toad, Hell calls them. Zack's mask has yet to attach fully around his eyes, but Marcus's clings tightly, having joined with him so completely that all of his features, even the thick slant of his eyebrows, are clearly visible beneath it. If Marcus tried to remove his mask now, he'd take off half his face with it, which would be an improvement. As if he senses her glance, Marcus turns and looks Helene over with a predatory gaze of ownership that makes my hands itch to strangle him. Nothing out of the ordinary, I remind myself. Nothing to make you stand out. I force myself to look away. Attacking Marcus in front of the entire school would definitely qualify as out of the ordinary. Helene notices Marcus's leer, her hands ball into fists at her sides, but before she can teach the snake a lesson, the sergeant-at-arms marches into the courtyard.
Attention!
3,000 bodies swing forward. 3,000 pairs of boots snap together. 3,000 backs jerk as if yanked straight by a puppeteer's hand. In the ensuing silence, you could hear a tear drop. But we don't hear the commandant of Blackcliff Military Academy approach. We feel her, the way you feel a storm coming. She moves silently, emerging from the arches like a fair-haired jungle cat from the underbrush. She wears all black, from her tight-fitting uniform jacket to her steel-toed boots. Her blonde hair is pulled, as always, into a stiff knot at her neck. She's the only living female mask, or will be until Helene graduates tomorrow. But unlike Helene, the Commandant exudes a deathly chill, as if her grey eyes and cut-glass features were carved from the underbelly of a glacier.
"Bring the accused," she says.
A pair of legionnaires march out from behind the bell tower, dragging a small, limp form. Beside me, Demetrius tenses. The rumors were right. The deserter's a fourth yearling, no older than 10. Blood drips down his face, blending into the collar of his black fatigues. When the soldiers dump him before the commandant, he doesn't move. The commandant's silver face reveals nothing as she looks down at the yearling, but her hand strays toward the spiked riding crop at her belt, fashioned out of bruised black ironwood. She doesn't remove it. Not yet.
"Fourth yearling, Falconius Barius."
Her voice carries, though it's soft, almost gentle.
"You abandoned your post at Blackcliff with no intention of returning. Explain yourself."
"No explanation, Commandant, sir."
He mouths the words we've all said to the Commandant 100 times. The only words you can say at Blackcliff when you've screwed up utterly. It's a trial to keep my face blank, to drive emotion from my eyes. Barius is about to be punished for the crime I'll be committing in less than 36 hours. It could be me up there in 2 days, bloodied, broken.
"Let us ask your peers their opinion."
The Commandant turns her gaze on us, and it's like being blasted by a frigid mountain wind.
"Is Yearling Barius guilty of treason?"
"Yes, sir!"
The shout shakes the flagstones, rabid in its ferocity.
"Legionnaires," the Commandant says, "take him to the post."
The resulting roar from the students jerks Barius out of his stupor, and as the legionnaires tie him to the whipping post, he writhes and bucks. His fellow fourth yearlings, the same boys he fought and sweated and suffered with for years, thump the flagstones with their boots and pump their fists in the air. In the row of senior skulls in front of me, Marcus shouts his approval, his eyes lit with unholy joy. He stares at the Commandant with a reverence reserved for deities. I feel eyes on me. To my left, one of the centurions is watching. Nothing out of the ordinary. I lift my fist and cheer with the rest of them, hating myself. The Commandant draws her crop, caressing it like a lover. Then she brings it whistling down onto Barius's back. His gasp echoes through the courtyard, and every student falls silent, united in a shared, if brief, moment of pity. Blackcliff's rules are so numerous that it's impossible not to break them at least a few times. We've all been tied to that post before. We've all felt the bite of the Commandant's crop. The quiet doesn't last. Barius screams, and the students howl in response, flinging jeers at him. Marcus is loudest of all, leaning forward, practically spitting in excitement. Farris rumbles his approval. Even Demetrius manages a shout or two, his green eyes flat and distant, as if he is somewhere else entirely. Beside me, Helene cheers, but there's no joy in her expression, only a stern sadness. The rules of Blackcliff demand that she voice her anger at the deserter's betrayal, so she does. The Commandant seems indifferent to the clamor, fixated as she is on her work. Her arm rises and falls with a dancer's grace. She circles Barius as his skinny limbs begin to seize, pausing between each lash, no doubt pondering how she can make the next one more painful than the last. After 25 lashes, she takes him by his limp stalk of a neck and turns him around.
"Face them," she says. "Face the men you've betrayed."
Barius's eyes beseech the courtyard, seeking out anyone willing to offer him a shred of pity. He should have known better.
His gaze collapses to the flagstones. The cheers continue, and the crop comes down again and again. Barius falls to the white stones, the pool of blood around him spreading rapidly. His eyes flutter. I hope his mind is gone. I hope he can't feel it anymore. I make myself watch. This is why you're leaving, Elias. So you're never a part of this again. A gurgling moan trickles from Barius's mouth. The commandant drops her arm, and the courtyard is silent. I see the deserter breathing. In once, out, and then nothing. No one cheers. Dawn breaks, the sun's rays tracing the sky above Blackcliff's ebony bell tower like bloodied fingers, tinging everyone in the courtyard a lurid red. The commandant wipes her crop on Barius's fatigues before returning it to her belt.
Take him to the dunes, she orders the legionnaires. For the scavengers.
Then she surveys the rest of us.
Duty first, unto death. If you betray the Empire, you will be caught, and you will pay. Dismissed!
The lines of students dissolve. Dex, who brought the deserter in, slips away quietly, his darkly handsome face slightly sick. Farris lumbers after, no doubt to clap Dex on the back and suggest he forget his troubles at a brothel. Demetrius stalks off alone, and I know he's remembering that day, 2 years ago, when he was forced to watch his little brother die just like Barius. He won't be fit to speak with for hours. The other students strain out of the courtyard quickly, still discussing the whipping.
Only 30 lashes. What a weakling. Did you hear him gasping? Like a scared girl. Elias.
Helene's voice is soft, as is the touch of her hand on my arm.
Come on. The commandant will see you.
She's right. Everyone is walking away. I should too. I can't do it. No one looks at Barius's bloody remains. He is a traitor. He is nothing. But someone should stay. Someone should mourn him, even if for a moment.
Elias,
Helene says, urgent now.
Move. She'll see you.
I need a minute, I reply.
You go on.
She wants to argue with me, but her presence is conspicuous, and I'm not budging. She leaves with a last backward glance. When she's gone, I look up to see the commandant watching me. We lock eyes across the long courtyard, and I am struck for the 100th time at how different we are. I have black hair, she has blonde. My skin glows golden brown, and hers is chalk white. Her mouth is ever disapproving, while I look amused even when I'm not. I am broad-shouldered and well over 6 feet, while she is smaller than a scholar woman even, with a deceptively willowy form. But anyone who sees us standing side by side can tell what she is to me. My mother gave me her high cheekbones and pale grey eyes. She gave me the ruthless instinct and speed that make me the best student Blackcliff has seen in 2 decades. Mother. It's not the right word. Mother evokes warmth and love and sweetness. Not abandonment in the tribal desert hours after birth. Not years of silence and implacable hatred. She's taught me many things, this woman who bore me. Control is one of them. I tamp down my fury and disgust, emptying myself of all feeling. She frowns, a slight twist of her mouth, and raises a hand to her neck, her fingers following the whorls of a strange blue tattoo poking out of her collar. I expect her to approach and demand to know why I'm still here, why I challenge her with my stare. She doesn't. Instead, she watches me for a moment longer before turning and disappearing beneath the arches. The bell tower tolls six, and the drums thud. All students report to mess. At the foot of the tower, the legionnaires heave up what's left of Barius and carry him away. The courtyard stands silent, empty except for me staring at a puddle of blood where a boy once stood, chilled by the knowledge that if I'm not careful, I'll end up just like him.
Chapter 5. Lyre. The silence of the catacombs is as vast as a moonless night, and as eerie, which isn't to say that the tunnels are empty. As soon as I drop through the grate, a rat skitters across my bare feet, and a clear, fist-sized spider descends on a thread inches from my face. I bite my hand so I don't scream. Save Darren. Find the resistance. Save Darren. Find the resistance. Sometimes I whisper the words. Mostly I chant them in my head. They keep me moving, a charm to ward off the fear nipping at my mind. I'm not sure, really, what I should be looking for. A camp? A hideout? Any sign of life that isn't rodent in nature? Since most of the Empire's garrisons are located east of the Scholars' Quarter, I head west. Even in this sky's forsaken place, I can point unfailingly to where the sun rises and where it sets, to the Empire's capital in the north, Antium and to Navium, its main port due south. It's a sense I've had for as long as I can remember. When I was a child and Sarah should have seemed vast to me, I was always able to find my way. I take heart from it. At least I won't be wandering in circles. For a time, sunshine trickles into the tunnels through the catacomb grates, weakly lighting the floor. I hug the crypt-pocked walls, swallowing my revulsion at the reek of rotting bones. A crypt is a good place to hide if a martial patrol gets too close. Bones are just bones, I tell myself. A patrol will kill you. In the daylight, it's easier to push away my doubts and convince myself that I'll find the resistance. But I wander for hours, and eventually the light fades and night falls, dropping like a curtain over my eyes. With it, fear comes rushing into my mind, a river that's broken a dam. Every thump is a murderous ox soldier, every scritch a horde of rats. The catacombs have swallowed me as a python swallows a mouse. I shudder, knowing that I have a mouse's chance of survival down here. Save Darren. Find the resistance. Hunger gathers into a knot in my stomach, and thirst burns my throat. I spot a torch flickering in the distance, and feel a moth-like urge to head toward it. But the torches mark Empire territory, and the ox soldiers who get tunnel duty are probably plebeians, the most low-born of the marshals. If a group of plebes catches me down here, I don't want to think of what they'll do. I feel like a hunted, craven animal, which is exactly how the Empire sees me, how it sees all scholars. The Emperor says that we are a free people who live under his benevolence. But that's a joke. We can't own property or attend schools, and even the mildest transgression results in enslavement. No one else suffers such harshness. Tribesmen are protected under a treaty during the invasion. They accepted martial rule in exchange for free movement for their people. Mariners are protected by geography and the vast amounts of spices, meat, and iron they trade. In the Empire, only scholars are treated like trash. Then defy the Empire, Lyre. I hear Darren's voice. Save me. Find the resistance. The darkness slows my footsteps until I'm practically crawling. The tunnel I'm in narrows, the walls crowding closer. Sweat pours down my back and my whole body quakes. I hate small spaces. My breath echoes raggedly. Somewhere ahead, water falls in a lonely drip. How many ghosts haunt this place? How many vengeful spirits roam these tunnels? Stop, liar. No such things as ghosts. As a child, I spent hours listening to tribal tale spinners weave their legends of the mythical fae, the Nightbringer and his fellow djinn, ghosts, ifrits, wraiths, and wights. Sometimes the tales spilled into my nightmares. When they did, it was Darin who calmed my fears. Unlike tribesmen, scholars are not superstitious, and Darin has always had a scholar's healthy skepticism. No ghosts here, liar. I hear his voice in my mind and close my eyes, pretending he's beside me, allowing myself to be reassured by his steady presence. No wraiths either. There's no such thing. My hand goes to my armlet, as it always does when I need strength. It's nearly black with tarnish, but I prefer it that way. It draws less attention. I trace the pattern in the silver, a series of connecting lines that I know so well I see it in my dreams. Mother gave me the armlet the last time I saw her, when I was 5. It's one of the few clear memories I have of her. The cinnamon scent of her hair, the sparkle in her storm sea eyes. Keep it safe for me, little cricket. Just for a week. Just until I come back. What would she say now, if she knew I'd kept the armlet safe but lost her only son? That I'd saved my own neck and sacrificed my brother's? Set it right. Save Darin. Find the resistance. I release the armlet and stumble on. Soon after, I hear the first sounds behind me. A whisper. The scrape of a boot on stone. If the crypts weren't silent, I doubt I'd have noticed. The sounds are so quiet. Too quiet for an ox soldier. Too furtive for the resistance. A mask. My heart thumps and I whirl, searching the tarry blackness. Masks can prowl through darkness like this as easily as if they are part wraith. I wait, frozen, but the catacombs fall silent again. I don't move. I don't breathe. I hear nothing. Rat. It's just a rat. A really big one, maybe. When I dare to take another step, I catch a whiff of leather and wood smoke. Human smells. I drop and search the floor with my hands for a weapon, a rock, a stick, a bone, anything to fight off whoever is stalking me. Then tinder hits flint. A hiss splits the air, and a moment later, a torch catches fire with a whoosh. I stand, shielding my face with my hands, the impression of the flame pulsing behind my lids. When I force my eyes open, I make out a half-dozen hooded figures in a circle around me, all with loaded bows pointed at my heart. "Who are you?" one of the figures says, stepping forward. Though his voice is cool and flat as a legionnaire's, he doesn't have the breadth and height of a marshal. His bare arms are hard with muscle, and he moves with fluid grace. A knife rests in one hand like it's an extension of his body, and he holds the torch in his other. I try to find his eyes, but they're hidden beneath the hood.
Speak.
After hours of silence, I can barely manage a croak. I'm looking for... Why didn't I think this through? I can't tell them I'm looking for the resistance. No one with half a brain would admit to seeking out the rebels.
Check her, the man says when I don't go on.
Another of the figures, slight and womanly, slings her bow on her back. The torch sputters behind her, casting her face into deep shadow. She looks too small to be a marshal, and the skin of her hands doesn't have the dark hue of a mariner's. She's probably either a scholar or a tribeswoman. Maybe I can reason with her. Please, I say, let me...
Shut it, the man who'd spoken before says. Sunna? Anything?
Sunna. A scholar name, short and simple. If she were Marshall, her name would have been Agrippina Cassius, or Chrysilla Araman, or something equally long and pompous. But just because she's a scholar doesn't mean I'm safe. I've heard rumours of scholar thieves lurking in the catacombs, popping through grates to grab, raid, and usually kill whoever is nearby before dropping back into their lair. Sunna runs her hands over my legs and arms. An armlet, she says. Might be silver. I can't tell. You're not taking that! I jerk away from her, and a thief's bows, which had dropped a notch, come back up. Please, let me go. I'm a scholar. I'm one of you. Get it done, the man says. Then he signals to the rest of his band, and they begin to slip back into the tunnels. Sorry about this, Sunna sighs, but she has a dagger in her hand now. I retreat a step. Don't. Please. I knot my fingers together to hide their tremor. It was my mother's. It's the only thing I have left of my family. Sunna lowers the knife, but then the leader of the thieves calls to her and, seeing her hesitation, stalks toward us. As he does, one of his men signals to him. Keenan, heads up. Ox patrol.
Pair and scatter.
Keenan lowers his torch.
If they follow, lead them away from base, or you'll answer for it. Sunna, get the girl silver and let's go.
We can't leave her, Sunna says. They'll find her. You know what they'll do.
Not our problem.
Sunna doesn't move, and Keenan shoves the torch into her hands. When he takes me by the arm, Sunna gets between us. We need silver, yes, she says, but not from our own people. Leave her. The unmistakable, clipped cadence of martial voices carries down the tunnel. They haven't seen the torchlight yet, but they will in just a few seconds.
Damn it, Sunna!
Keenan tries to go around the woman, but she shoves him away with surprising force, and her hood falls back. As the torchlight illuminates her face, I gasp. Not because she's older than I thought, or because of her fierce animosity, but because on her neck, I see a tattoo of a closed fist raised high with a flame behind it. Beneath it, the word Izzat.
You're...
I can't get the words out. Keenan's eyes fall on the tattoo, and he swears.
Now you've done it, he says to Sunna. We can't leave her. If she tells them she saw us, they'll flood these tunnels until they find us.
He puts out the torch with brute swiftness and grabs my arm, pulling me after him. When I stumble into his hard back, he jerks his head around, and for a second, I catch the angry shine of his eyes. His scent, sharp and smoky, wafts over me. Keep quiet and watch your step. He's closer than I realized, his breath warm against my ear. Or I'll knock you senseless and leave you in one of the crypts. Now move. I bite my lip and follow, trying to ignore his threat, and instead focus on Sunna's tattoo. Izzat. It's old Rai, the language spoken by scholars before the marshals invaded and forced everyone to speak Saren. Izzat means many things. Strength, honor, pride. But in the past century, it's come to mean something specific. Freedom. This is no band of thieves. It's the resistance.
Chapter 6 Elias. Varius's screams blister my brain for hours. I see his body fall, hear the rasp of his last breath, smell the taint of his blood on the flagstones. Student deaths don't usually hit me this way. They shouldn't. The Reaper's an old friend. He's walked with all of us at Blackcliff at some point. But watching Varius die was different. For the rest of the day, I'm short-tempered and distracted. My odd mood doesn't go unnoticed.
As I trudge to combat training with a group of other senior skulls, I realize Faris has just asked me a question for a third time.
You look like your favorite whore's caught the pox,
he says when I mutter an apology.
What the hell is wrong with you?
Nothing. I realize too late how angry I sound, how unlike a skull on the verge of maskhood. I should be excited, bursting with anticipation. Faris and Dex trade a skeptical glance, and I stifle a curse.
You sure?
Dex asks. He's a rule follower, Dex. Always has been. Every time he looks at me, I know he's wondering why my mask hasn't joined with me yet.
Piss off,
I want to say to him. Then I remind myself that he's not prying. He's my friend, and he's genuinely worried.
This morning, he says, at the whipping, you were... Hey, leave the poor man be.
Aline strolls up behind us, flashing a smile at Dex and Faris, and throwing a careless arm around my shoulders as we enter the armory. She nods at a rack of sims.
Go on, Elias. Pick your weapon. I challenge you. Best of three.
She turns to the others and murmurs something as I walk away. I lift a blunted practice sim, checking its balance. A moment later, I feel her cool presence beside me.
What did you tell them?
I ask her.
That your grandfather's been hounding you.
I nod. The best lies come from the truth. Grandfather is a mask, and like most masks, he's never satisfied with anything less than perfection.
Thanks, Hel. You're welcome. Repay me by pulling yourself together.
She crosses her arms at my frown.
Dex is your platoon lieutenant, and you didn't commend him after he caught a deserter. He noticed. Your entire platoon noticed. And at the whipping, you weren't... with us.
If you're saying that I wasn't baying for the blood of a 10-year-old, you'd be right. Her eyes tighten, enough for me to know that some part of her sympathizes with me, even if she'll never admit it.
Marcus saw you stay behind after the whipping. He and Zack are telling everyone that you thought the punishment was too harsh.
I shrug, as if I care what the snake and toad say about me.
Don't be an idiot. Marcus would love to sabotage the heir to Jens Veturia a day before graduation.
She refers to my familial house, one of the oldest and most respected in the Empire, by its formal title.
He's all but accusing you of sedition.
He accuses me of sedition every other week.
But this time, you did something to earn it.
My eyes jerk to hers, and for one tense moment, I think she knows everything. But there's no anger or judgment in her expression, only concern. She counts off my sins on her fingers.
You're squad leader of the platoon on watch, yet you don't bring Barius in yourself. Your lieutenant does it for you, and you don't commend him. You barely contain your disapproval when the deserter's punished, not to mention the fact that it's the day before graduation, and your mask has only just begun to meld with you.
She waits for a response, and when I give none, she sighs.
Unless you're stupider than you look, even you can see how this appears, Elias. If Marcus reports you to the Black Guard, they might have enough evidence to pay you a visit.
A prickle of unease creeps down my neck. The Black Guard is tasked with ensuring the loyalty of the military. They wear the emblem of a bird, and their leader, once picked, gives up his name and is known simply as the Bloodshrike. He's the right hand of the Emperor and the second most powerful man in the Empire. The current Bloodshrike has a habit of torturing first and asking questions later. A midnight visit from those black-armored bastards will land me in the infirmary for weeks. My entire plan will be ruined. I try not to glare at Helene. Must be nice to believe so fervently in what the Empire spoon-feeds us.
Why can't I just be like her, like everyone else?
Because my mother abandoned me.
because I spent the first 6 years of my life with tribesmen who taught me mercy and compassion instead of brutality and hatred. Because my playfellows were tribes' children, mariners and scholars instead of other illustrians. Hel hands me a sim.
Fall in, she says. Please, Elias, just for a day. Then we're free.
Right. Free to report for duty as full-fledged servants of the Empire, after which we'll lead men to their deaths in the never-ending border wars with wildmen and barbarians. Those of us not ordered to the border will be given city commands, where we'll hunt down resistance fighters or mariner spies. We'll be free, all right. Free to lord the Emperor. Free to rape and kill. Funny how that doesn't seem like freedom. I keep quiet. Helene's right. I'm drawing too much attention to myself, and Blackcliff is the worst place to do so. Students here are like starving sharks when it comes to sedition. One whiff of it, and they swarm. For the rest of the day, I do my best to act like a mask on the verge of graduation. Smug, brutish, violent. It's like covering myself in filth. When I return to my cell-like quarters in the evening for a precious few minutes of free time, I tear off my mask and toss it on my cot, sighing when the liquid metal releases its hold. At the sight of my reflection in the mask's polished surface, I grimace. Even with the thick black lashes that Farris and Dex love to mock, my eyes are so much my mother's that I hate seeing them. I don't know who my father is, and I no longer care, but for the 100th time, I wish that he'd at least given me his eyes. Once I escape the Empire, it won't matter. People will see my eyes and think Marshal instead of Commandant. Plenty of Marshals roam the South as merchants, mercenaries, and craftsmen. I'll be one among the hundreds. Outside, the bell tower tolls 8. 12 hours until graduation. 13 until the ceremony is done. Another hour for pleasantries. Gens Veturia is a distinguished house, and Grandfather will want me to shake dozens of hands. But eventually, I'll beg off, and then... freedom. At last. No student has ever deserted after graduating. Why would they? It's the hell of Blackcliff that drives its students to run. But after we're out, we get our own commands, our own missions. We get money, status, respect. Even the lowest-born plebeian can marry high, if he becomes a mask. No one with any sense would turn his back on that, especially after nearly a decade and a half of training. Which is what makes tomorrow the perfect time to run. The 2 days after graduation are madness. Parties, dinners, balls, banquets. If I disappear, no one will think to look for me for at least a day. They'll assume I've drunk myself into a stupor at a friend's house. The passageway that leads from below my hearth into Sarah's catacombs pulses at the edge of my vision. It took me 3 months to dig out that damn tunnel. Another 2 months to fortify and hide it from the prying eyes of Orcs patrols, and 2 more months to map out the route through the catacombs and out of the city. 7 months of sleepless nights and peering over my shoulder and trying to act normal. If I escape, it will all have been worth it. The drums beat, signaling the start of the graduation banquet. Seconds later, a knock comes at my door. 10 hells. I was supposed to meet Helene outside the barracks, and I'm not even dressed yet. Helene knocks again.
Elias, stop curling your eyelashes and get out here. We're late.
Hang on, I say. As I pull off my fatigues, the door opens and Helene marches in. A blush blooms up her neck at my undressed state, and she looks away. I raise an eyebrow. Helene has seen me naked dozens of times, when wounded, or ill,
or suffering through one of the Commandant's cruel strength training exercises. By now, seeing me stripped shouldn't cause her to do anything more than roll her eyes and throw me a shirt.
Hurry up, would you?
She fumbles to break the silence that's descended. I grab my dress uniform off a hook and button it on quickly, edgy at her awkwardness.
The guys already went ahead. Said they'd save us seats.
Helene rubs the Blackcliff tattoo on the back of her neck, a four-sided black diamond with curved sides that is inked into every student upon arrival at the school. Helene took it better than most of our class fellows, stoic and tearless, while the rest of us whimpered. The augurs have never explained why they only choose one girl per generation for Blackcliff, not even to Helene. Whatever the reason, it's clear they don't select at random. Helene might be the only girl here, but there's a reason she's ranked third in our class. It's the same reason that bullies learned early on to leave her alone. She's clever, swift, and ruthless. Now, in her black uniform, with her shining braid encircling her head like a crown, she's as beautiful as winter's first snow. I watch her long fingers at her nape, watch her lick her lips. I wonder what it would be like to kiss that mouth, to push her to the window and press my body against hers, to pull out the pins in her hair, to feel its softness between my fingers.
Elias?
Hmm? I realize I've been staring and snap out of it.
Fantasizing about your best friend, Elias. Pathetic.
Sorry, just... tired. Let's go. Elle gives me a strange look and nods at my mask, still sitting on the bed.
You might need that.
Right. Appearing without one's mask is a whipping offense. I haven't seen any skull maskless since we were 14. Other than Hell, none of them have seen my face either. I put the mask on, trying not to shudder at the eagerness with which it attaches to me.
One day left.
Then I'll take it off forever. The sunset drums thunder as we emerge from the barracks. The blue sky deepens to violet, and the searing desert air cools. Evening's shadows blend with the dark stones of Blackcliff, making the blockish buildings appear unnaturally large. My eyes rove the shadows, seeking out threats, a habit from my years as a fiver. I feel, for an instant, as if the shadows are looking back at me. But then the sensation fades.
Do you think the augurs will attend graduation?
Hell asks. No, I want to say. Our holy men have better things to do, like locking themselves up in caves and reading sheep entrails. Doubt it, is all I say.
I guess it would get tedious after 500 years.
Helene says this without a trace of irony, and I wince at the sheer idiocy of the idea. How can someone as intelligent as Helene actually think the augurs are immortal? But then, she's not the only one. Marshals believe that the augurs' power comes from being possessed by the spirits of the dead. Masks, in particular, revere the augurs, for it is the augurs who decide which marshal children will attend Blackcliff. It is the augurs who give us our masks, and we're taught that it was the augurs who raised Blackcliff in a single day, 5 centuries ago. There are only 14 of the red-eyed bastards, but on the rare occasions that they appear, everyone defers to them. Many of the Empire's leaders, generals, the Bloodshrike, even the Emperor, make a yearly pilgrimage to the Augur's mountain lair, seeking counsel on matters of state. And though it's clear to anyone with an ounce of logic that they are a pack of charlatans, they're lionized throughout the Empire, not just as immortal, but as oracles and mind readers. Most Blackcliff students only see the augurs twice in our lives, when we're chosen for Blackcliff and when we're given our masks. But Helene has always had a particular fascination with the holy men, It's no surprise that she hoped they'd come to graduation. I respect Helene, but on this, we don't agree. Martial myths are as believable as tribal fables of Jin and the Nightbringer. Grandfather is one of the few masks who doesn't believe in augur rubbish, and I repeat his mantra in my head. The field of battle is my temple. The sword point is my priest. The dance of death is my prayer. The killing blow is my release. The mantra is all I've ever needed. It takes all my control to hold my tongue. Helene notices.
Elias, she says, I'm proud of you.
Her tone is strangely formal.
I know you've struggled. Your mother...
She glances around and drops her voice. The Commandant has spies everywhere.
Your mother's been harder on you than any of the rest of us. But you showed her. You worked hard. You did everything right.
Her voice is so sincere that for a moment I waver. In 2 days, she won't think such things. In 2 days, she will hate me. Remember, Barius. Remember what you'll be expected to do after graduation. I jostle her shoulder.
Are you turning sappy and girly on me? Forget it, swine!
She punches me on the arm.
I was just trying to be nice.
My laugh is falsely hearty. They'll send you to hunt me down when I run. You and the others, the men I call brothers. We reach the mess hall, and the cacophony within hits us like a wave. Laughter and boasts and the raucous talk of 3,000 young men on the verge of leave or graduation. It's never this loud when the Commandant is in attendance, and I relax marginally, glad to avoid her. Hel pulls me to one of the dozens of long tables, where Faris is regaling the rest of our friends with a tale of his latest escapade at the Riverside brothels. Even Demetrius, ever haunted by his dead brother, cracks a smile. Faris leers, glancing between us suggestively.
You two took your time.
Vittorius was making himself pretty just for you.
Hel shoves Faris's boulder-like body over, and we sit.
I had to drag him away from his mirror.
The rest of the table hoots, and Leander, one of Hel's soldiers, calls for Faris to finish his story. Beside me, Dex is arguing with Hel's second lieutenant, Tristus. He's an earnest, dark-haired boy, with a deceptively innocent look to his wide blue eyes, and his fiancée's name, Aelia, tattooed in block letters on his bicep. Tristus leans forward.
The Emperor's nearly 70, and he has no male issue. This year might be the year. The year the Augurs choose a new Emperor, a new dynasty. I was talking to Aelia about it.
Every year someone thinks it's the year.
Dex rolls his eyes.
Every year it's not. Elias, tell him. Tell Tristus he's an idiot.
Tristus, you're an idiot.
But the augurs say...
I snort quietly, and Helene gives me a sharp look.
Keep your doubts to yourself, Elias.
I busy myself with piling food on 2 plates and shove one toward her. Here, I say. Have some slop.
What is it, anyway?
Hel pokes at the mash and takes a tentative sniff.
Cow dung?
No whining,
Faris says through a mouthful of food.
Pity the fivers. They have to come back to this after 4 years of happily robbing farmhouses.
Pity the yearlings,
Demetrius counters.
Can you imagine another 12 years? 13?
Across the hall, most of the yearlings smile and laugh like everyone else. But some watch us, the way starving foxes might watch a lion, hungry for what we have. I imagine half of them gone, half the laughter silenced, half the bodies cold. But that is what will happen in the years of deprivation and torment ahead of them.
and they will face it either by living or dying, either by accepting or questioning. The ones who question are usually the ones who die. They don't seem to care much about Barius. The words are out of my mouth before I can help myself. Beside me, Aline's body stiffens like water freezing into ice. Dex frowns in disapproval, a comment dying on his lips, and silence falls across our table.
Why would they be upset?
Marcus, sitting one table away with Zack and a knot of cronies, speaks up.
That scum got what he deserved. I only wish he'd lasted longer so he could have suffered more. No one asked what you think, Snake,
Helene says.
Anyway, kid's dead now.
Lucky him.
Barris picks up a forkful of food and lets it plop unappetizingly back onto his steel plate.
At least he doesn't have to eat this swill anymore.
A low chuckle runs up and down the table, and conversation picks up again. But Marcus smells blood, and his malevolence taints the air. Zack turns his gaze to Helene and mutters something to his brother. Marcus ignores him, fixing his hyena eyes on me.
You were damn broken up over that traitor this morning, Veturius. Was he a friend? Piss off, Marcus. Been spending a lot of time down in the catacombs, too. What is that supposed to mean?
Helene's hand is on her weapon, and Farris grabs her arm. Marcus ignores her.
You gonna do a runner, Veturius?
My head comes up slowly. It's a guess. He's guessing. There's no way he could know. I've been careful, and careful at Blackcliff translates to paranoid for most people. Silence falls at my table, at Marcus's.
Deny it, Elias. They're waiting.
You were squad leader on watch this morning, weren't you?
Marcus says.
You should have been thrilled to see that traitor go down. You should have brought him in. Say he deserved it, Veturius. Say Barius deserved what he got.
It should be easy. I don't believe it, and that's what matters. But my mouth won't move. The words won't come. Barius didn't deserve to be whipped to death. He was a child, a boy so afraid of staying at Blackcliff that he'd risked everything to escape it. The silence spreads. A few centurions look up from the head table. Marcus stands, and, quick as a flood, the mood of the hall changes, turning curious and expectant.
Son of a whore.
Is this why your mask hasn't joined with you?
Marcus says.
Because you're not one of us. Say it, Veturius. Say the traitor deserved his fate.
Elias,
Helene whispers. Her eyes plead.
Fall in, just for one more day.
He...
Say it, Elias. Doesn't change anything if you do.
He deserved it.
I meet Marcus's eyes coolly, and he grins, like he knows how much the words cost.
Was that so hard, bastard?
I'm relieved when he insults me. It gives me the excuse I've wanted so badly. I spring toward him, fists first. But my friends are expecting it. Farris, Demetrius, and Helene are on their feet, holding me back, an irritating wall of black and blonde keeping me from beating that damn grin off Marcus's face.
No, Elias, Helene says. The Commandant will whip you for starting a fight. Marcus isn't worth that. He's a bastard.
That'd be you, actually, Marcus says. At least I know who my father is. I wasn't raised by a pack of camel-stroking tribesmen.
You plebeian trash.
Senior Skulls!
The Sim Centurion has made his way to the foot of the table.
Is there a problem?
No, sir,
Helene says.
Go, Elias, she murmurs. Go get some air. I'll handle this.
My blood's still burning,
I shove through the mess doors and find myself in the bell tower courtyard before I even know where I'm going. How the hell did Marcus figure out that I'm going to desert? How much does he know? Not too much, or I'd have been called to the Commandant's office by now. Damn him! I'm close. So close. I pace the courtyard, trying to calm myself. The desert heat has faded, and a crescent moon hangs low on the horizon, thin and red as a cannibal's smile. Through the arches, Sarah's lights glow dully, tens of thousands of oil lamps dwarfed by the vast darkness of the surrounding desert. To the south, a pool of smoke mutes the shine of the river. The smell of steel and forge wafts past, ever present in a city known solely for its soldiers and weaponry. I wish I could have seen Sarah before all this, when it was capital of the Scholar Empire. Under the scholars, the great buildings were libraries and universities instead of barracks and training halls. The street of storytellers was filled with stages and theatres, instead of an arms market where the only stories told now are of war and death. It's a stupid wish, like wanting to fly. For all their knowledge of astronomy and architecture and mathematics, the scholars crumbled beneath the Empire's invasion. Sarah's beauty is long gone. It's a martial city now. Above, the heavens glow, the sky pale with starlight. Some long-buried part of me understands that this is beauty, but I am unable to wonder at it, the way I did when I was a boy. Back then, I clambered up spiky jack trees to get closer to the stars, sure that a few feet of height would help me see them better. Back then, my world had been sand and sky and the love of Tribe Scythe, who saved me from exposure. Back then, everything was different.
All things change, Elias Venturius. You are no boy now, but a man, with a man's burden upon your shoulders, and a man's choice ahead of you.
My knife is in my hands, though I don't remember drawing it, and I hold it to the throat of the hooded man beside me. Years of training keep my arm steady as a rock, but my mind races. Where had the man come from? I'd swear on the lives of everyone in my platoon that he hadn't been standing there a moment ago. Who the hell are you? He pulls down his hood, and I have my answer. Augur.
Chapter 7. Liar. We race through the catacombs, Keenan ahead of me, Sana at my heels. When Keenan is convinced we've left the Ox Patrol behind, he slows our pace and barks at Sana to blindfold me. I flinch at the harshness in his tone. This is what's become of the Resistance, this band of thugs and thieves. How did it happen?
Only 12 years ago, the rebels were at the height of their power, allying themselves with the tribes and the King of Marin.
They'd lived their code. Izzat, fighting for freedom, protecting the innocent, elevating loyalty to their own people above all else. Does the Resistance remember that code anymore? On the off chance that they do, will they help me? Can they help me? You'll make them help you. Darren's voice again, confident and strong, like when he taught me to climb a tree, like when he taught me to read. We're here, Sana whispers after what feels like hours. I hear a series of knocks and the scrape of a door opening. Sana guides me forward, and a burst of cool air washes over me, fresh as spring after the stench of the catacombs. Light creeps through the edges of my blindfold. The rich green smell of tobacco curls up into my nose, and I think of my father, smoking a pipe as he drew pictures of a Fritz and whites for me. What would he say if he saw me now, in a Resistance hideout? Voices mutter and murmur. Warm fingers tangle in my hair, and a moment later, my blindfold falls away.
Keenan is right behind me.
Sunna, he says. Give her some neem leaf and get her out of here.
He turns to another fighter, a girl a few years older than me, who flushes when he speaks to her.
Where's Mazin? Have Raj and Navid reported yet?
What's neem leaf? I ask Sunna when I'm sure Keenan can't hear. I've never heard of it, and I know most herbs from working with Pop. It's an opiate. It'll make you forget the last few hours. At my widening eyes, she shakes her head. I won't give it to you. Not yet, anyway. Have a seat. You look a mess. The cavern we're in is so dark, it's hard to tell how big it is. Blue fire lanterns, usually found in the finest Illustrian neighborhoods, glow here and there with pitch torches flickering between them. Clean night air flows through a constellation of gaps in the rock ceiling, and I can barely make out the stars. I must have been in the catacombs for nearly a day. It's drafty. Sunna pulls off her cloak, and her short, dark hair tufts out like a disgruntled bird's. But it's home.
Sunna, you're back.
A stocky, brown-haired man approaches, looking at me curiously.
Tarik, Sunna greets him. We ran into a patrol, picked up someone on the way. Grab us some food, would you?
Tarik disappears, and Sunna gestures for me to sit on a nearby bench, ignoring the stares coming our way from the dozens of people moving about the cavern. There are an equal number of men and women here, most in dark, close-fitting clothing, and nearly all dripping with knives and sims, as if expecting an empire raid any moment. Some sharpen weapons, others watch over cook fires. A few older men smoke pipes. The bunks along the cabin wall are filled with sleeping bodies. As I look around, I push a hank of hair out of my face. Sunna's eyes narrow when she takes in my features. You look familiar, she says. I allow my hair to fall forward again. Sunna's old enough to have been in the resistance for quite some time, old enough to have known my parents. I used to sell Nan's jams at market. Right. She's still staring. You live in the quarter. Why were you...
Why is she still here?
Keenan, who's been busy with a group of fighters in the corner, approaches, pulling back his hood. He's far younger than I expected, closer to my age than Sunna's, which might explain why she bristles at his tone. Flame-red hair spills over his forehead and into his eyes, so dark at the roots it's almost black. He's only a few inches taller than me, but lean and strong, with a scholar's even, fine features. A hint of ginger stubble shadows his jaw, and freckles spatter his nose. Like the other fighters, he wears nearly as many weapons as a mask. I realize I'm staring and glance away, heat rising in my cheeks. Suddenly, the looks he's been getting from the younger women in the cavern make sense.
She can't stay, he says. Get her out of here, Sunna. Now.
Tarik returns and, overhearing Keenan, slams a plate of food onto the table behind me.
You don't tell her what to do. Sunna's not some besotted recruit. She's the head of our faction and you...
Tarik. Sunna puts a hand on the man's arm, but the look she gives Keenan could wither stone. I was giving the girl some food. I wanted to find out what she was doing in the tunnels. I was looking for you, I say. For the resistance? I need your help. My brother was taken in a raid yesterday.
We can't help, Keenan says. We're stretched thin as it is.
But
we can't help.
He speaks slowly as if I'm a child. Maybe before the raid, the chill in his eyes would have silenced me. But not now. Not when Darren needs me.
You don't lead the resistance, I say.
I'm second in command.
He's higher up than I expected, but not high enough. I shake my hair out of my face and stand. Then it's not up to you,
Whether I stay or not, it's up to your leader. I try to sound brave, although if Keenan disagrees, I don't know what I'll do. Start begging, maybe. Sana's smile is sharp as a knife. Girl's got a point. Keenan moves toward me until he's standing uncomfortably close. He smells of lemon and wind and something smoky, like cedar. He takes me in from head to toe, and the look would be shameless if it wasn't for the slight puzzlement in his face, like he's seeing something he doesn't quite understand. His eyes are a dark secret, black or brown or blue, I can't tell. It feels as if they can see right through me to my weak, cowardly soul. I cross my arms and look away, embarrassed of my tattered shift, of the dirt, the cuts, the damage.
That's an unusual armlet.
He reaches out a hand to touch it. The tip of his finger grazes my arm, sending a spark skittering across my skin, and I jerk away. He doesn't react.
So tarnished. I might not have noticed it.
It's silver, isn't it? I didn't steal it, all right? My body aches and my head spins, but I bunch my fists, afraid and angry all at once. And if you want it, you'll have to kill me to get it. He meets my eyes coolly, and I hope he doesn't call my bluff. He and I both know that killing me wouldn't be particularly difficult.
I expect I would, he says. What's your name?
Liar. He doesn't ask for a family name. Scholars rarely take them. Sana looks between us, bemused.
I'll go get Maz. No, Keenan's already walking away. I'll find him.
I sit back down, and Sana keeps glancing at my face, trying to puzzle out why I look familiar. If she'd seen Darren, she'd have known right away. He's the spitting image of our mother, and no one could forget mother. Father was different, always in the background, drawing, planning, thinking. He gave me his unruly midnight hair and gold eyes, his high cheekbones and full, unsmiling lips. In the quarter, no one knew my parents. No one looked twice at Darren or me. But a resistance camp is different. I should have realized that. I find myself staring at Sana's tattoo, and my stomach lurches at the sight of the fist and flame. Mother had one just like it, above her heart. Father spent months perfecting it before inking it into her skin. Sana sees me staring. When I got this tattoo, the resistance was different, she explains without my asking. We were better. But things changed. Our leader, Mazin, told us we needed to be bolder, to go on the attack. Most of the young fighters, the ones Mazin trains, tend to agree with that philosophy. It's clear Sana's not happy about this. I'm waiting for her to say more when a door opens on the far side of the cavern to admit Keenan and a limping, silver-haired man.
Lawyer, Keenan says. This is Mazin. He's
leader of the resistance. I know his name because my parents spoke it often when I was a child. And I know his face because it's on wanted signs all over Sarah.
So, you're our orphan of the day.
The man comes to a stop before me, waving me back down when I rise to greet him. He has a pipe clenched in his teeth, and the smoke blurs his ravaged face. The resistance tattoo, faded but still visible, is a blue-green shadow on the skin below his throat.
What is it you want?
My brother Darren's been taken by a mask. I watch Mazin's face carefully to see if he recognizes my brother's name. But he gives nothing away. Last night, in a raid at our house, I need your help to get him back.
We don't rescue strays.
Mazin turns to Keenan.
Don't waste my time again.
I try to quash my desperation. Darren's no stray. He
He wouldn't have even been taken if it wasn't for your men.
Mazin swings around.
My men?
Two of your fighters were interrogated by the marshals. They gave Darin's name to the Empire before they died.
When Mazin looks at Keenan for confirmation, the younger man fidgets.
Raj and Navid,
he says after a pause.
New recruits. Said they were working on something big. Eren found their bodies in the west end of the Scholar's Quarter this morning. I heard a few minutes ago.
Mazin swears and turns back to me.
Why would my men give the Empire your brother's name? How do they know him?
If Mazin doesn't know about the sketchbook, I'm not about to tell him. I don't understand what it means myself.
I don't know, I say. Maybe they wanted him to join. Maybe they were friends. Whatever the reason, they led the Empire to us. The mask who killed them came for Darin last night. He...
My voice fails, but I clear my throat and force myself to keep talking.
He killed my grandparents. He took Darin to jail. Because of your men.
Mazin takes a long draw on his pipe, contemplating me before shaking his head.
I'm sorry for your loss, truly. But we can't help you.
You? You owe me a blood debt. Your men gave up Darin.
And paid for it with their lives. You can't ask for more than that.
The little interest Mazin took in me disappears.
If we helped every scholar taken by the marshals, there'd be nothing left of the resistance. Maybe if you were one of our own, he shrugs. But you're not.
What about Izzat?
I grab his arm, and he pulls away, anger flashing in his eyes.
You're bound to the code. Bound to aid any who...
The code applies to our own. Members of the resistance. Their families. Those who have given everything for our survival. Keenan, give her the leaf.
Keenan takes one of my arms, holding on tightly even when I try to throw him off.
Wait, I say. You can't do this.
Another fighter comes to restrain me.
You don't understand. If I don't get him out of prison, they'll torture him. They'll sell him or kill him. He's all I have. He's the only one left.
Mazin keeps walking.
Chapter 8. Elias. The whites of the augur's eyes are demon red, vivid against his jet irises. His skin stretches across the bones of his face like a tortured body on the rack. Other than his eyes, he has no more color to him than the translucent spiders that lurk in Sarah's catacombs. Nervous, Elias. The augur pushes my knife away from his throat. Why? You needn't fear me. I'm only a cave-dwelling charlatan, a reader of sheep's entrails, yes? Burning, bleeding skies. How does he know I thought such things? What else does he know? Why is he even here? That was a joke, I say hastily. A stupid, stupid joke. Your plan to desert. Is that a joke also? My throat tightens. All I can think is, how does he... Who told him? I'll kill them! The ghosts of our misdeeds seek vengeance, the augur says. But the cost will be high. The cost... It takes me a second to understand. He's going to make me pay for what I was planning to do. The night air is colder suddenly, and I remember the din and stench of Koff Prison, where the Empire sends defectors to suffer at the hands of its most ruthless interrogators. I remember the Commandant's whip and Barius's blood staining the courtyard stones. My adrenaline surges, my training kicking in, telling me to attack the augur, to rid myself of this threat. But common sense overrules instinct. The augurs are so highly respected that killing one isn't an option. Groveling, however, might not hurt. I understand, I say. I will humbly accept any punishment you deem. I am not here to punish you. In any case, your future is punishment enough. Tell me, Elias, why are you here? Why are you at Blackcliff?
To carry out the will of the Emperor. I know these words better than my own name. I've said them so many times. To keep away threats, internal and external, to protect the Empire. The auger turns to the diamond-patterned bell tower. The words emblazoned in the tower's bricks are so familiar, I hardly notice them anymore. From among the battle-hardened youth, there shall rise the foretold, the greatest emperor, scourge of our enemies, commander of a host most devastating, and the Empire shall be made whole. The foretelling, Elias, the augur says. The future given to the augurs in visions. That is the reason we built this school. That is the reason you are here. Do you know the story?
The story of Blackcliff's origin was the first thing I learned as a yearling. 500 years ago, a warrior brute named Tyus united the fractured martial clans and swept down from the north, crushing the Scholar Empire and taking over most of the continent. He named himself Emperor and established his dynasty. He was called the Masked One, with the unearthly silver mask he wore to scare the hell out of his enemies. But the augurs, considered holy even then, saw in their visions that Tyus's line would one day fail. When that day came, the augurs would choose a new emperor through a series of physical and mental tests, the trials. For obvious reasons, Tyus didn't appreciate this prediction, but the augurs must have threatened to strangle him with sheep gut because he didn't make a peep when they raised Blackcliff and began training students here. And here we all are. 5 centuries later, masked just like Tyus the First, waiting for the old devil's line to fail so one of us can become the shiny new emperor. I'm not holding my breath. Generations of masks have trained and served and died without a whisper of the trials. Blackcliff may have started out as a place to prepare the future emperor, but now it's just a training ground for the Empire's deadliest asset. I know the story, I say in response to the augur's question. But I don't believe a word of it, since it's mythical horse dung.
Neither mythical nor horse dung, I'm afraid,
the augur says soberly. It becomes harder to breathe suddenly. I haven't felt fear in so long that it takes me a second to recognize it. You can read minds.
A simplistic statement for a complex endeavor. But yes, we can.
Then you know everything. My plan to escape, my hopes, my hates, everything. No one turned me into the auger. I turned myself in.
It's a good plan, Elias,
the auger confirms.
Nearly foolproof. If you wish to carry it out, I will not stop you.
Trick! My mind screams. But I look into the augur's eyes and see no lie there. What game is he playing? How long have the augurs known that I want to desert?
We've known for months. But it wasn't until you hid your supplies in the tunnel this morning that we understood you had committed yourself. We knew then we had to speak with you.
The auger nods to the path that leads to the eastern watchtower.
Walk with me.
I'm too numb to do anything but follow. If the auger isn't trying to keep me from deserting, then what does he want? What did he mean when he said my future would be punishment enough? Is he telling me I'll be caught? We reach the watchtower, and the sentries stationed there turn and walk away, as if following a silent order. The auger and I are alone, looking out over darkened sand dunes that stretch all the way to the Seren mountain range.
When I hear your thoughts, I'm reminded of Tyus the First, the augur says. Like you, soldiering was in his blood, and like you, he struggled with his destiny.
The augur smiles at my stare of disbelief.
Oh yes, I knew Tyus. I knew his forefathers. My kindred and I have walked this land for 1,000 years, Elias. We chose Tyus to create the Empire, just as we chose you, 500 years later, to serve it.
Impossible, my logical mind insists. Shut it, logical mind. If this man can read minds, then immortality seems like the next reasonable step. Does this mean all that drivel about the augurs being possessed by spirits of the dead is true? If only Helene could see me, how she'd gloat. I watch the augur out of the corner of my eye. As I take in his profile, I find that it's suddenly oddly familiar.
My name is Cain, Elias. I brought you to Blackcliff. I chose you.
Condemned me, more like. I try not to think of the dark morning the Empire claimed me, but it haunts my dreams still. The soldiers surrounding the Scythe caravan, dragging me from my bed. Mamie Reela, my foster mother, shrieking at them until her brothers pulled her back. My foster brother, Sean, rubbing the sleep from his eyes, bewildered, asking when I would return. And this man, this thing, pulling me to a waiting horse with the barest explanation.
You've been chosen. You will come with me.
In my terrified child's mind, the augur seemed larger, more menacing. Now he comes to my shoulder and looks as if a stiff wind could knock him into the grave. I imagine you've chosen thousands of children over the years. I take care to keep my tone respectful. That's your job, isn't it?
But you are the one I remember best. For the augurs dream the future, all outcomes, all possibilities. And you are woven through every dream, a thread of silver in a tapestry of night.
And here I thought you drew my name out of a hat.
Hear me, Elias Vittorius.
The augur ignores my barb, and though his voice is no louder than it was a moment ago, his words are wrapped in iron, weighted down in certainty.
The foretelling is truth, a truth you will soon face. You seek to run. You seek to abandon your duty, but you cannot escape your destiny.
Destiny? I laugh, a bitter thing. What destiny? Everything here is blood and violence. After I graduate tomorrow, nothing will change. The missions, the rote viciousness, will wear me down until there's nothing left of the boy the augur stole 14 years ago. Maybe that's a type of destiny, but it's not one I'd choose for myself.
This life is not always what we think it will be,
Cain says.
You are an ember in the ashes, Elias Vittorius. You will spark and burn, ravage and destroy. You cannot change it. You cannot stop it.
I don't want...
What you want doesn't matter. Tomorrow, you must make a choice. Between deserting and doing your duty. Between running from your destiny and facing it. If you desert, the augurs will not stop you. You will escape. You will leave the Empire. You will live. But you will find no solace in doing so. Your enemies will hunt you. Shadows will bloom in your heart, and you will become everything you hate. Evil, merciless,
cruel. You will be chained to the darkness within yourself, as surely as if chained to the walls of a prison cell.
He moves toward me, his black eyes pitiless.
But if you stay, if you do your duty, you have a chance to break the bonds between you and the Empire forever. You have a chance at greatness you cannot conceive. You have a chance at true freedom, of body and of soul.
What do you mean, if I stay and do my duty?
What duty? You'll know when the time comes, Elias. You must trust me.
How can I trust you when you won't explain what you mean? What duty? My first mission? My second? How many scholars will I have to torment? How much evil will I commit before I'm free? Cain's eyes are fixed on my face as he takes one step away from me and then another.
When can I leave the Empire? In a month? A year? Cain!
He fades as quickly as a star into the dawn. I reach out to grab him, to force him to stay and answer me. But my hand finds only air.
Chapter 9. Liar. Keenan pulls me to a cavern door, and I hang limp, my breath gone from my body. His mouth moves, but I can't hear what he's saying. All I can hear are Darin's screams, echoing in my ears. I'll never see my brother again. The marshals will sell him if he's lucky, and kill him if he's not. Either way, there's nothing I can do about it.
Tell them, Leia, Darin whispers in my head. Tell them who you are.
They might kill me, I argue back. I don't know if I can trust them.
If you don't tell them, I'll die,
Darin's voice says.
Don't let me die, Liar.
The tattoo on your neck, I shout at Mazin's retreating back. The fist and flame? My father put it there. You are the second person he tattooed after my mother. Mazin stops. His name was John. You called him Lieutenant. My sister's name was Liss. You called her the Little Lioness. For a second I falter, and Mazin turns around, a muscle in his jaw jumping. Speak, Liar. He's actually listening. My mother's name was Mira. But you, everyone, called her the Lioness, leader, head of the Resistance. Keenan releases me as quickly as if my skin has turned to ice. Sunna's gasp echoes in the sudden silence of the cavern. She'll know now why she'd found me familiar. I glance around at the shocked faces uneasily. My parents were betrayed from within the Resistance. Nan and Pop never learned who it was. Mazin says nothing. Please, don't let him be the traitor. Let him be one of the good ones. If Nan could see me, she'd throttle me. I've kept the secret of my parents' identities all my life. Telling it makes me feel hollow inside. And what happens now? All of these rebels, many of whom fought alongside my parents, suddenly know whose child I am. They'll want me to be fearless and charismatic, like Mother. They'll want me to be brilliant and serene, like Father. But I'm not any of those things. You served with my parents for 20 years, I say to Mazin. In Marin, and then here, in Sarah. You joined up the same time as my mother. You rose to the top with her and my father. You were third in command. Keenan's eyes flash between Mazin and me, the rest of his face still. Work in the cabin halts, and fighters whisper to each other as they gather around us.
Mira and John had one child. Mazin limps toward me.
His eyes go from my hair, to my eyes, to my lips as he remembers.
compares.
She died when they did.
No. I've held this in for so long that it feels wrong to speak of it. But I have to. It is the only thing I can say that might make a difference. My parents left the resistance when Lys was 4. They were expecting Darren. They wanted a normal life for their children. They disappeared. No trace. No trail. Darren was born. Then, 2 years later, I arrived. But the Empire was coming down hard on the resistance. Everything my parents worked for was crumbling. They couldn't sit by and watch. They wanted to fight. Lys was old enough to stay with them, but Darren and I were too young. They left us with Mother's parents. Darren was 6. I was 4. They died a year later.
You tell a good tale, girl, Mazin says. But Mira didn't have parents. She was an orphan, like me, like John.
I'm not telling tales. I pitch my voice low so it doesn't shake. Mother left home when she was 16. Nan and Pop didn't want her to go. After she left, she cut off all contact. They didn't even know she was alive until she knocked on their door asking them to take us in.
You're nothing like her.
He might as well have slapped me. I know I'm not like her, I want to say. I cried and cringed instead of standing and fighting. I abandoned Darren instead of dying for him. I'm weak in a way she never was. Mazin, Sana whispers, like I'll disappear if she speaks too loudly. Look at her. She has John's eyes. His hair. 10 hells. She has his face. I swear it's true. This armlet... I lift my hand and it glints in the cavern's light. It was hers. She gave it to me a week before the Empire caught her.
I'd wondered what she'd done with it.
The stiffness in Mazin's face dissolves, and the light of an old memory flares in his eyes.
John gave it to her when they got married. I never saw her without it. Why didn't you come to us before? Why didn't your grandparents contact us? We'd have trained you up the way Mira would have wanted.
The answer dawns on his face before I can say it.
The traitor, he says.
My grandparents didn't know who to trust. They decided not to trust anyone.
And now they're dead. Your brother is in jail, and you want our help.
Mazin brings his pipe back to his mouth. We must give her aid. Sana is beside me, her hand on my shoulder. It's our duty. She's, as you say, one of our own. Tarek stands behind her, and I notice that the fighters have divided into 2 groups. The ones backing Mazin are closer to Keenan's age. The rebels, clustered behind Sana, are older. She's the head of our faction, Tarek had said. Now I realize what he meant. The resistance is divided. Sana leads the older fighters, and, as she'd hinted at before, Mazin leads the younger ones and serves as overall leader. Many of the old fighters stare at me, perhaps searching my face for evidence of mother and father. I don't blame them. My parents were the greatest leaders in the resistance's 500-year history. Then they'd been betrayed by one of their own, caught, tortured, executed along with my sister, Lys. The resistance collapsed and never recovered. If the lioness's son is in trouble, we owe it to her to help, Sana says to those gathered behind her. How many times did she save your life, Mazin? How many times did she save all of us? Suddenly, everyone is talking. Mira and I set fire to an Empire garrison. She could cut right to your soul with her eyes, the lioness. Saw her fend off 12 oxes once. Not a bit of fear in her. I have stories of my own. She wanted to leave us.
She wanted to abandon her children for the resistance, but father wouldn't let her. When they fought, Lys took me and Darin into the forest and sang so he wouldn't hear them. That's my first memory. Lys singing me a song while the lioness raged a few yards away. After my parents left us with Nan and Pop, it took weeks for me to stop feeling jumpy, to get used to living with two people who actually seemed to love each other. I say none of this. Instead, knotting my fingers together as the fighters tell their stories. I know they want me to be brave and charming, like Mother. They want me to listen, really listen, like Father. If they learn what I truly am, they'll throw me out of here without a thought. The Resistance doesn't tolerate weaklings.
Liar, Mazin speaks over them, and they quiet down. We don't have the manpower to break into a martial prison. We'd risk too much.
I don't get the chance to protest because Sun is speaking for me. The lioness would have done it for you without a second thought.
We have to bring down the Empire, a blonde man behind Mazin says. Not waste our time saving some boy.
We don't abandon our own. We'll be the ones doing all the fighting.
Another of Mazin's men calls from the back of the crowd.
Well, you old-timers sit around taking all the credit.
Taric shoves past Sana, his face dark.
You mean while we plan and prepare to make sure you young fools don't get ambushed?
Enough! Enough!
Mazin raises his hands. Sana pulls Taric back and the other fighters fall silent.
We won't solve this by shouting at each other. Kenan, find Hyder and bring him to my chambers. Sana, get Eren and join us. We'll decide this privately.
Sana hurries away, but Kenan doesn't move. I flush beneath his stare, not sure what to say. His eyes are almost black in the cavern's dim light. I see it now, he murmurs, as if to himself. I can't believe I almost missed it. He can't have known my parents. He doesn't look much older than me. I wonder how long he's been in the Resistance. But before I ask, he disappears into the tunnels, leaving me to stare after him. Hours later, after I've forced food down my throat and pretended to sleep on a rock-hard bunk after the stars had faded and the sun has risen, one of the cavern doors swings open. Mazin enters, followed by Kenan, Sana, and two younger men. The Resistance leader limps to a table where Taric is sitting and gestures me over. I try to read Sana's face as I join them, but her expression is carefully neutral. The other fighters gather around, as interested as I am to see what my fate will be.
Liar, Mazin says. Kenan here thinks we should keep you in camp. Safe,
Mazin infuses the word with scorn. Beside me, Taric looks askance at Kenan.
She'll cause less trouble here, the red-haired fighter's eyes flash. Breaking her brother out will cost men. Good men.
He stops at a look from Mazin and clamps his mouth shut. And though I hardly know Kenan, I'm stung at how violently he's opposing me. What have I ever done to him?
It will cost good men, Mazin says. Which is why I've decided that if Lyra wants our help, she has to be willing to give us something in return.
Fighters from both factions eye their leader warily. Mazin turns to me.
We'll help you, if you help us.
What could I possibly do for the Resistance?
You can cook, yes?
Mazin asks.
And clean? Dress hair, press clothing?
Make soap, wash dishes, barter, yes! You've just described every free woman in the Scholar's Quarter.
You can read too, Mazin says.
When I begin to deny the charge, he shakes his head.
Empire rules be damned. You forget I knew your parents.
What does any of that have to do with helping the Resistance?
We'll break your brother out of prison if you spy for us.
For a moment,
I don't speak. Though I feel a tug of curiosity, this is the last thing I expected.
Who do you want me to spy on?
The Commandant of Blackcliff Military Academy.
Chapter 10. Elias. The morning after the Augur's visit, I stumble to the mess hall like a cadet suffering his first hangover, cursing the overly bright sun. What little sleep I got was sabotaged by a familiar nightmare, one in which I wander through a stinking, body-strewn battlefield. In the dream, screams rend the air, and somehow I know that the pain and suffering are my fault, that the dead have fallen by my hand. Not the best way to start a day, especially graduation day. I run into Helene as she, Dex, Faris, and Tristus leave mess. She stuffs a rock-hard biscuit into my hand, ignoring my protests, and pulls me away from the hall. We're late. I barely hear her over the ceaseless beating of the drums, which are ordering all graduates to the armory to pick up our ceremonials, the armor of a full mask. Demetrius and Leander already left. Helene chatters about how thrilling it will be to put on our ceremonials. Dimly, I listen to her and the others, nodding at appropriate times, exclaiming when necessary. All the while, I'm thinking of what Cain said to me last night. You will escape. You will leave the Empire. You will live. But you will find no solace in doing so. Do I trust the Augur? He could be trying to trap me here, hoping I'll stay a mask long enough to decide that a soldier's life is better than an exile's. I think of how the Commandant's eyes shine when she whips a student, how Grandfather boasts of his body count. They are my kin. Their blood is my blood. What if their lusts for war and glory and power are mine too, and I just don't know it? Could I learn to revel in being a mask? The Augur read my thoughts. Does he see something evil inside me that I'm too blind to face? But then, Cain seemed convinced that I'd meet the same fate if I deserted. Shadows will bloom in your heart, and you will become everything you hate. So my choices are to stay and be evil, or to run and be evil. Wonderful. When we are halfway to the armory, Hel finally notices my silence, taking in the rumpled clothing, the bloodshot eyes. You all right? She asks. Fine. You look like hell. Rough night. What happened? Faris, walking ahead with Dex and Tristus, drops back. Leave him alone, Aquila. The man's tuckered out. Snuck down to the docks to celebrate a bit early, eh, Vitorius? He claps me on the shoulder with a big hand and laughs. Could have invited a fellow along. Don't be disgusting, Helene says. Don't be a prude, Faris retorts. A full-scale argument ensues, during which Helene's disapproval of prostitutes is vehemently shouted down by Faris, while Dex argues that leaving school grounds to visit a brothel isn't strictly forbidden. Tristus points to the tattoo of his fiancée's name and declares neutrality. Amid the swift